how white he was, as white as a mask, upon which, like a bloodstain, those red, red lips, a sword in his right hand and a gun in his left. He was both things, swordsman and shootist, male and female, himself in his shadow as well. She abandoned Shah Ismail as he had abandoned her and chose again, this pale-faced woman-man. Afterwards, he would claim her and her mirror as spoils of war, and Salim the Grim would agree. But she had chosen him long before, and it was her will that moved everything that followed. "Don't be afraid," he said in Persian. "Nobody in this place knows the meaning of fear," she replied. And beneath those words, the real words, "Will you be mine?" "Yes, I am yours."
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulubim. Author Salman Rushdie, or Sir Salman Rushdie, is of course best known for the infamous fatwa incited by his dazzlingly dark 1989 novel, The Satanic Verses. Rushdie is an equal opportunity critic of anti-humanist movements, ranging from religious fundamentalism to colonialism. But he's also a lushly funny writer who brings together East and West in imaginative novels, including the Booker Award-winning Midnight's Children and his latest, The Enchantress of Florence. It's set during the European Renaissance, but hardly limited to that continent. Sir Rushdie read from The Enchantress of Florence in June 2008 at the Sixth and I Historic Synagogue in Washington, D.C.
All right. Thank you. You see what happens when you get to be a knight? People do what you say. No, they don't. Yes, about the question of East and West meeting each other, what's interesting about this period, the late 15th to the mid-16th century, is it's the moment when certainly India and the West first encountered each other, when that connection first began. And sometimes I thought it's interesting to go back to the beginning of a story in order to get some sense of why it turned out the way it did. It's the story of a story, this story. It begins with a traveler, young, fair-haired, handsome, European-looking guy, showing up at the capital of the Mughal Empire in Fatehpur Sikri in India with a very tall story to tell, and actually kind of a dangerous story, because what he's doing is claiming kinship with the emperor, claiming to be the descendant of a lost princess who would have been the emperor's great aunt, who would have been the sister of the first emperor, Babur, who was originally captured by a rival warlord and then for a time liberated by and then lived as the mistress of the Shah of Persia, and eventually, according to his story, fell in love with an Italian soldier of fortune who brought her back to Florence, where she created all kinds of trouble, and she's probably a witch. And more importantly, that he's descended from her, he claims. So it's a kind of, it's a game of high-stakes poker, because if he can convince the emperor that he's telling the truth, and after all, he has nothing except the power of his story to do it, because, you know, there's no DNA testing in the 16th century, then that means he's a prince of the royal house. And if he doesn't succeed, and if the emperor thinks he's a con artist, it could cost him his life. So he's telling his story for very high stakes. And anyway, that's what it's about. Why do people do that? Why do people cross the world in order to risk their lives? And I think part of it has to do with just the enormous importance we all feel as human beings to have our story told and to have it heard and understood. Anyway, I was going to read you a bit which is actually not set either in India or in the West. Because, of course, one of the great things about the world of those days is that there were no airplanes. So if you're going to actually travel across the world, you can't go automatically from India to Europe. You have to go through everything in between. And this passage I'm going to read you is a passage about actually when the two lovers in the story, within the story, first meet the mislaid princess, Caracos, which means black eyes, and the Italian soldier of fortune, whose name is Argalia, who at this point is working as a mercenary, I guess, as a janissary soldier for the Ottoman army, for the Ottoman sultans. The janissaries were this army largely composed of mercenaries and retrained slaves and so on, and they were kind of the marines of this pre-modern world. They were the most feared fighting force. One of the things I should mention is that one of the pleasures of writing this book is that I found out all kinds of things that were literally stranger than fiction. And I should just say that all the really weird stuff in this book is true. And all the relatively banal stuff in it is the stuff that I made up. And just to give you an example of it, because it crops up in this passage, the warlord who first captured the, what she's called, the hidden princess, Karakoz, was a man, an actual historical figure called Shaibani Khan, a name which translates roughly as Lord Wormwood. Anyway, he was eventually defeated and killed by the Shah of Persia, Shah Ismail I of Persia, who, having defeated and killed him, chopped off his body, sent the parts of the body around the empire to prove that he was dead, had his skull set with gold and jewels and turned into a wine goblet, and used to drink from it in the evenings, and then had a better idea and sent it as a present to the Ottoman Sultan in Istanbul, essentially to say, this is what I just did to the guy I didn't like on my eastern frontier. And since you're the guy on my western frontier, I thought you might be interested to see it. And the Ottoman response to this was to send a gigantic army to fight him. And this resulted in a battle that I'm going to tell you about, one of the great battles of this period. It's called the Battle of Chaldiran, which took place on what is now the Turkish Persian-Iranian border, and in many ways is the battle which set the place where that border now is. So one of the kind of defining battles of the pre-modern world. All right, I think that's probably enough background. But as you see, I mean, skulls with gold, you know, skull-drinking goblets, you can't make that stuff up. There's even a passing reference in this section to Dracula. In another part of the novel, which I'm not going to read, Dracula actually makes a personal appearance. And I was so happy when I realized that the Ottomans had been fighting a war against Dracula at exactly the right time for my story. I thought I'd gone to heaven, really, when I realized I could have Dracula in the novel, which was not part of the original conception. Anyway, here we are. Argalia's 45th birthday had come and gone. He was a tall, pale man, and in spite of the years of war, his skin was as white as a woman's. Men and women alike marveled at its softness. He was a lover of tulips. Oh, I should say, tulips, by the way, in case you didn't know it, tulips originated in Turkey. They afterwards spread elsewhere, but that's where they started out. And I have to warn you in advance that there's a sort of bit of obscene tulip later on, but we'll cover it. These are the non-obscene tulips. He was a lover of tulips and had them embroidered onto his tunics and cloaks, believing them to be bringers of good fortune. And of the 1,500 varieties of Stamboul tulip, six in particular were to be found thronging his palace rooms. The light of paradise, the matchless pearl, the increaser of pleasure, the instiller of passion, the diamond's envy and the rose of the dawn, these were his favorites. And by them he was revealed as a sensualist beneath his warrior's exterior, a creature of pleasure hiding inside a killer's skin, a female self within the male. He had, too, a woman's taste for finery. When not in battle dress, he lounged in jewels and silks and had a great weakness for exotic furs, the black fox and lynx of Muscovy, which came down to Stamboul through Feodosia in the Crimea. His hair was long and black as evil, and his lips were full and red as blood. Blood and its shedding had been his life's concern. Under Sultan Mehmed II, he had fought a dozen campaigns and won every battle in which he raised his arquebus to the firing position or unsheathed his sword. He had drawn a platoon of loyal Janissaries around him like a shield, with the Swiss giants Otho, Botho, Clotho, and D'Artagnan as his lieutenants. And though the Ottoman court was full of intrigues, he had foiled seven assassination attempts. After Mehmed's death, the empire came close to civil war between his two sons, Bayezid and Shem. When Argalia learned that the Grand Vizier, in defiance of Muslim tradition, refused to bury the dead Sultan's body for 3 days so that Shem could reach Stamboul and seize the throne, he led the Swiss giants to the Vizier's quarters and killed him. He led Bayezid's army against the would-be usurper and drove him into exile. Once that was done, he became the new Sultan's commander-in-chief. He fought the Mamluks of Egypt by land and sea, and when he vanquished the alliance of Venice, Hungary, and the papacy, his reputation as an admiral equaled his fame as a warrior on dry land. After that, the main problems came from the Kizilbash people of Anatolia. They wore red hats with 12 pleats to show their fondness for 12-verse Shiism, and as a result, they were attracted to Shah Ismail of Persia, the self-styled very god. Bayezid's third son, Selim the Grim, wanted to crush them utterly, but his father was more restrained. As a result, Selim the Grim began to think of his father as an appeaser and a weakling. When the goblet from Shah Ismail arrived in Istanbul, I mentioned the goblet, Selim took it as a mortal insult. That heretic who calls himself by God's name should be taught his manners, he declared. He picked up the cup as a duelist picks up a glove that has struck him in the face. I will drink Safavid blood from this cup, he promised his father. Argalia, the Turk, stepped forward, and I will pour that wine, he said. Well, the old Sultan refuses permission for the war, and so, of course, they depose him and send him into exile. The old Sultan was banished into enforced retirement and died of a broken heart on the way, which was just as well. The world had no room for men who had lost their nerve. Selim, with Argalia at his side, hunted down and strangled all his brothers and killed their sons as well. Order was restored, and the risk of a coup eliminated. Then it was time to face Shah Ismail. Argalia and his janissaries were sent to Rum in north-central Anatolia, arrested thousands of Kizilbash residents, and slaughtered thousands more. That kept the bastards quiet, while the army marched across their land to deliver Selim the Grim's letter to the Shah. In this message, Selim said, "You no longer uphold the commandments and prohibitions of the divine law. You have incited your abominable Shiite faction to unsanctified sexual union, and you have shed innocent blood." This is early Sunni Shia trouble here. 100,000 Ottoman soldiers made camp at Lake Van in eastern Anatolia on the way to push these words down Shah Ismail's blasphemous throat. Among their ranks were 12,000 Janissary musketeers under Argalia's command. There were also 500 cannons chained together to form an impassable barrier. The battlefield of Chaldiran was to the northeast of Lake Van, and there the Persian forces made their stand. Shah Ismail's army was only 40,000 men strong, almost all of them cavalrymen. But Argalia, surveying their battle array, knew that superior numbers did not always decide a fight. Like Vlad Dracula in Wallachia, Ismail had used a scorched-earth strategy. Anatolia was bare and charred, and the advancing Ottomans found little to eat or drink. Selim's army was tired and hungry when it camped by the lake after its long march, and such an army is always beatable. Afterwards, when Argalia was with the hidden princess, she told him why her erstwhile lover had been bested. "Chivalry," she said, "foolish chivalry, and listening to some stupid nephew of his and not to me." The extraordinary fact is that the enchantress of Persia, along with her slave, the mirror, was present on the command hill above the field of battle, her thin veiling garment blowing against her face and breasts in the breeze so suggestively that when she stood outside the king's tent, her body's beauty turned the soldiers' thoughts entirely away from war. "He must have been mad to bring you," Argalia told her, when, blood filthy and kill sick, he found her abandoned at the death-heavy end of the day. "Yes," she said matter-of-factly, "I drove him mad with love." However, in the matter of military strategy, not even her enchantments could make him heed her. "Look," she cried, "they are still building their defensive fortifications. Attack now when they aren't ready." And, "Look," she cried, "they have 500 cannons chained in a line and 12,000 riflemen behind. Don't just gallop at them head on or you'll be cut down like fools." And, "Don't you have any guns? You know about guns. For pity's sake, why didn't you bring any guns?" To which the Shah's nephew, Durmish Khan the Fool, answered, "It would not be sportsmanlike to attack them when they are not ready to fight. And it would not be noble to send our men to attack them from the rear. And the gun is not a weapon for a man. The gun is for cowards who do not dare to fight at close quarters. Yet however many guns they have, we will take the fight to them until it is hand to hand. Courage will win the day, and not, ha, these arquebuses and muskets." She turned to Shah Ismail in a kind of laughing despair. "Tell this man he is an idiot," she commanded him. But Shah Ismail of Persia answered, "I am not a caravan thief to go skulking in the shadows. Whatever is decreed by God will occur." She refused to watch the battle, sitting instead inside the royal tent with her face turned away from the door. The mirror sat beside her and held her hand. Shah Ismail led a charge down the right wing that smashed the Ottoman left, but the enchantress had turned away her face. Both armies suffered terrible losses. The Persian cavalry cut down the flower of the Ottoman horsemen, the Illyrians, the Macedonians, the Serbians, the Epirots, Thessalians, and Thracians. On the Safavid side, the commanders fell one by one, and as they died, the enchantress in her tent murmured their names. Muhammad Khan Ustajlu, Hussein Beg Lala Ustajlu, Saru Pira Ustajlu, and so on, as if she could see everything without looking. And the mirror reflected her words so that the names of the dead seemed to echo in the royal tent. Amir Nizamuddin Abdelbaki, Al-Baki. But the name of the Shah, who believed himself to be God, was not spoken. The Ottoman center held, but the Turkish cavalry was on the verge of panic when Argalia ordered the artillery to be brought up. "You bastards," he screamed at his own Janissaries, "if any of you try to run, I'll turn the fucking cannons on you." The Swiss giants, armed to the teeth, ran on foot along the Ottoman battle line to add emphasis to Argalia's threats. Then the thunder of the guns began. "The storm has started," the enchantress said, sitting in her tent. "The storm," the mirror replied. There was no need to look as the Persian army died. It was time to sing a sad song. Shah Ismail was alive, but the day was lost. He had fled the battlefield, wounded, without coming for her. She knew it. "He has gone," she told the mirror. "Yes, he has gone," the other assented. "We are at the enemy's mercy," the enchantress said. "Mercy," the mirror replied. The men posted outside the tent to guard them had run away as well. They were two women alone upon a field of dreadful blood. That was how Argalia found them, sitting unveiled and straight-backed and alone, facing away from the door of the royal tent at the end of the Battle of Chaldiran and singing a sad song. The princess Karakoz turned to face him, making no attempt to shield the nakedness of her features from his gaze, and from that moment on they could only see each other and were lost to the rest of the world. "He looked like a woman," she thought, "like a tall, pale, black-haired woman who had glutted herself on death. How white he was, as white as a mask, upon which like a bloodstain those red, red lips, a sword in his right hand and a gun in his left. He was both things, swordsman and shootist, male and female, himself in his shadow as well. She abandoned Shah Ismail as he had abandoned her and chose again, this pale-faced woman-man. Afterwards he would claim her and her mirror as spoils of war, and Salim the Grim would agree, but she had chosen him long before, and it was her will that moved everything that followed. "Don't be afraid," he said in Persian. "Nobody in this place knows the meaning of fear," she replied. And beneath those words, the real words, "Will you be mine? Yes, I am yours." Okay, well, they go back to Istanbul, to the Topkapi Palace, and this is the obscene tulip bit. When she undressed Argalia and found tulips embroidered on his underclothes, she understood that he was addicted to his superstitions, that like any man whose work is death, he did what he could to ward off the last day. When she removed his undergarments and found them tattooed on his shoulder blades and buttocks, and even on the thick shaft of his penis, she knew for certain that she had met the love of her life. "You don't need those flowers anymore," she told him, caressing them. "Now you have me instead to be your good luck charm." He thought, "Yes, I have you, but only until I don't. Only until you choose to leave me as you left your sister, to change horses again as you changed from Shah Ismail to me. A horse is only a horse, after all." She read his mind, and seeing that he needed further reassurances, she clapped her hands. The mirror came into the flower-heavy bedchamber. "Tell him who I am," she said. "She is the lady who loves you," the mirror said. "She can charm the snakes from the ground and the birds from the trees and make them fall in love, and she has fallen in love with you. So now you can have anything you desire." The enchantress made a small movement of her eyebrow, and the mirror let her clothes fall to the floor and slipped into the bed. "She is my mirror," the enchantress said. "She is the shadow that shines. Who wins me gets her as well." At this point, Argalia, the great warrior, admitted defeat. In the face of such an outflanking assault, the only course left to a man was unconditional surrender. For many years, he'd had the honor of being permitted as a recipient of the Sultan's favor to reside in chambers at the abode of bliss, the Topkapi, instead of the Spartan accommodation at the Janissary barracks. Now that the chambers had the added grace of a woman's touch, they began to feel like a true home. But home was always a troubled, dangerous idea for men like Argalia to allow themselves to believe in. It could catch at them like a noose. Salim did not think of Argalia as his indispensable right-hand man, but as a probable and dangerous rival for power, a popular general who could lead his Janissaries into the inner sanctum of the palace, just as he'd done once before when he killed the Grand Vizier. A man capable of murdering the Vizier was also capable of regicide. Such a man had perhaps outlived his usefulness. As soon as they were back in Istanbul, the Sultan, while publicly lavishing praise on his Italian commanding officer for his part in the famous victory of Chaldiran, began secretly to plot Argalia's destruction. News of Argalia's precarious position came to his ears on account of Karakoz's decision to continue to satisfy his love of tulips. There were gardens all round the abode of bliss, walled gardens and sunken gardens, woodland areas where deer wandered freely and waterside lawns sloping down to the Golden Horn. The tulip beds were to be found in the fourth court and on the low hill at the northern end of the Topkapi complex, the highest point in the entire abode of bliss, where there were small wooden pleasure pavilions called kiosks. The tulips grew around them in great numbers and created an air of fragrant serenity and peace. The princess and her mirror, demurely veiled, often walked in these gardens and rested in the kiosks, drinking sweet juices, speaking gently to the many palace bostanchis, the gardeners, to get them to gather flowers for Lord Argalia, and to prattle idly, as women will, about the innocent gossip of the day. Soon all the garden staff, from the lowliest weed puller to the bostanchi basha, the head gardener himself, were deeply enamored of the two ladies and consequently loose-tongued, as only true lovers are. Many of them remarked how swiftly the two foreign ladies had become proficient in the Turkish language, almost overnight, or so it seemed. As if by magic, the gardeners said. But Karakoz's true purposes were far from innocent. She knew, as all new residents of the abode of bliss swiftly came to know, that the 1,001 Bostanchis were not only the Sultan's gardeners, but his official executioners as well. If a woman was convicted of a crime, it was a Bostanchi who sewed her, still alive, into a sack weighted down with stones and threw her into the Bosphorus. And if a man was to be killed, a group of gardeners grabbed him and performed an act of ritual strangulation. This is true, by the way. You see what I mean about the weird stuff being true? So Karakoz befriended the Bostanchis and learned what they called, with dark humor, the tulip news. And soon enough, the stink of betrayal began to overpower the fragrance of the flowers. The gardeners warned her that her lord, the great general, servant of three sultans, was in danger of being tried on trumped-up charges and sentenced her to death. The head gardener himself told her so. The Bustanchi Basha of the abode of bliss was the Sultan's executioner in chief, chosen not only for his horticultural skills, but also for his running speed, because when a grandee of the court was condemned to death, he was given a chance not granted to common men. If he could outrun the Bustanchi Basha, he could live. His sentence would be commuted to banishment. But the Bustanchi Basha was famous for being able to run like the wind, so the chance was in reality no chance at all. On this occasion, however, the gardener was not happy about what he would have to do. "To execute such a great man would make me feel ashamed," he said. "Then," said the enchantress, "we must find a way out of the situation, if we can." "He will kill you soon," she came home and told Argalia. "The gardens are full of rumor." Argalia said gravely, "On what pretext, I wonder?" The princess took his pale face in her hands. "I am the pretext," she said. "You have taken a Mughal princess as a spoil of war. He did not know that when he gave you leave, but he knows it now. To capture a Mughal princess is an act of war against the Mughal king, and he will say, by placing the Ottoman Empire in such a position, you have committed treason and must pay the price. Such is the news the tulips have to tell." Forewarned, Argalia had time to make plans, and on the day they came for him, he had already sent Karakoz of the Mirror under cover of night, along with many treasure chests holding the wealth he had amassed on successful military campaigns and protected by the four Swiss giants and the entire company of his most loyal Janissaries, some 100 men in all, to wait for him at Bursa to the south of the capital. "If I run away with you," he said, "Salim will hunt us down and murder us like dogs. Instead, I must stand trial, and after I am condemned, I must win the gardener's race." It was what Karakoz had known he would say. "If you are determined to die," she told him, "I suppose I will have to allow it." By which she meant she would have to save his life. And it would be hard because she would not be present at the scene of the great race. As soon as Salim the Grim in the throne room of the abode of bliss pronounced the sentence of death on the traitor Argalia, the warrior, knowing the rules, spun on his heel and began to run. From the throne room to the fish house gate, it was about half a mile through the palace gardens, and he had to get there before the Bustanchi Basha in his red skull cap, white muslin breeches, and bare chest, who was already in hot pursuit and gaining on him with every stride. If he was caught, he would die at the fish house and be thrown into the Bosphorus, where all the dead bodies went. As he ran between the flower beds, he saw the fish house gate ahead, heard the footsteps of the Bustanchi Basha close behind him, and knew he could not run fast enough to escape. "Life is absurd," he thought, "to survive so many wars and then be strangled by the gardener." Truly, it is said, there are no heroes who do not learn the emptiness of heroism before they die. He remembered how, as a young boy, he had first discovered the absurdity of life, alone in a small rowboat in the middle of a naval battle in a fog. "All these years later," he thought, "I am having to learn the lesson all over again." No satisfactory explanation was ever given of why Sultan Salim the Grim's fleet-footed head gardener suddenly fell down, clutching his stomach, just 30 paces from the end of the gardener's race, or why he then succumbed to a bout of the foulest farting anyone had ever smelled, releasing blasts of wind as loud as gunshots and crying out in pain like an uprooted mandrake, while Argalia ran past the finishing post at the fish house gate, mounted the horse waiting for him, and galloped on into exile. "Did you do something?" Argalia asked his beloved when he met her at Bursa. "What could I have done to my dear little Basha?" she answered, wide-eyed. "To send him a message, thanking him in advance for slaying you, my vile abductor, along with a jug of Anatolian wine to demonstrate my gratitude? That is one thing, yes. But to calculate exactly how long a certain potion stirred into the wine would take before it had its effect on his stomach, why, that would be quite impossible, of course." When he looked into her eyes, he saw no sign of any subterfuge there. No indication that she, or her mirror, or both of them together, might have done anything to persuade the gardener to fail in his duty. Perhaps even to take the drink at a time specified in advance, in return for a moment of bliss that would last such a man a lifetime. No, Argalia told himself as Caracosa's eyes drew him deeply into their spell. Nothing of that sort could have happened. Behold the eyes of my beloved, how guileless they are, how full of love and truth. Thank you. All right. Thanks. So, your turn.
I think I'm probably not alone in believing that you've done the greatest possible honor to the vocation of storyteller and writer, and that you deserve, in consequence, and you've deserved for quite some time, the Nobel.
Well, there's 18 Swedish people you have to convince of that.
Yeah, right. Well, I was going to say, obviously, there's a problem there, and that it's unlikely, I think, that you'll ever get it.
Oh.
And I wonder, and I just would ask you to comment on that.
Yeah. No. You know, the thing about prizes is that you win them or you don't, you know? And I mean, I've had my share of winning them and my share of not winning them. And it is, on the whole, better when you do win. I mean, there's a wonderful moment when the English novelist Kingsley Amis won the Booker Prize. And in his acceptance speech, he said, you know, I've always despised this prize, but I've just changed my mind. So, you know, I mean, you can't expect these things ever to come your way. The fact is, there are more great writers in the world than will ever win the Booker Prize, the Nobel Prize. And if you look at the writers, for example, who did not win the Nobel Prize, it reads like the roll call of the greatest writers in 20th century fiction. You know, let's start with Joyce, Proust, and Kafka. You know, without whom you can't construct the 20th century in literature, and none of them won the Nobel Prize, and nor did Borges, and nor did Nabokov, and so on and so on and so on. You know, so it's a lottery. You have 18 people making a decision from all the writers in the world, and as I say, if it happens to fall on you, then they're obviously wise, and you know. and if it happens not to, then you can have a different opinion of them. But it you know, in the end, doesn't really matter. Yes.
I've always been interested in how your work extends in certain ways the tradition of novel writing that was perhaps first started by Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, writers who were grappling with what the West, which for them was Germany and France, sort of had as an influence on the non-West, which was for them their homeland, mm-hmm. Russia. Mm-hmm. And in certain ways, the plurality of the novel as a form seemed to have shaped them as much as they shaped their books. And I was just wondering what your relationship to the novel as a form, particularly with respect to its multivocal capacities and the plurality of the form, has how it's shaped your work and how that's changed over time.
That's such a brilliant question. I think one should just leave it as a question. No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about the way in which those great Russian writers defined East and West and the way in which it shaped their thinking. And I think even much more so now than then. I mean, I come from a kind of intermediate generation, which is the generation immediately following the decolonization of the East. You know, I'm 8 weeks older than the independent state of India. And so I was technically born under the British Empire, but it didn't last long once I arrived. I'm trying not to suggest any causal connection. But I do think that since that time, of course, And we've been through that whole period of post-colonial thinking, and I think we've actually now even beyond that in some ways, because I think if you're in India today, the legacy of the British Empire doesn't really seem to be there anymore. It seems to be a long time ago. Well, it is a long time ago. It's 61 years ago. But I do think we now live in this world which is, you know, which is very compressed. And it has a consequence, I think, or at least I've felt it has a consequence for literature, which is that you can't do, in many ways, what the novel was born to do, which is to write a parochial story of a little local place. You know, that, I mean, the novel, in some ways, wants to be parochial. It wants to be about Madame Bovary in a rural town, bored with her husband and looking for a lover. You know, it wants to be about Jane Austen's Bennet sisters living in the middle of nowhere, husband hunting. You know, it sort of doesn't want to be about everything. And the great danger of trying to write these sort of everything novels is that they can end up being nothing novels. You know, by trying to write about everything, you end up writing very, very superficially. You know, it becomes a kind of tourism, if you like. And yet, it has seemed to me very important to try and take up that challenge just because we don't lead these neatly segregated lives anymore. You know, all our little boxes in which we live all open out into other people's little boxes. And to understand what happens on this side of the world, you sometimes, as we now all understand, have to understand what's going on thousands of miles away in other parts of the world. And so to find stories which try and explore how the world joins up, you know, and how this part of it affects that part of it, that if you like a kind of literary version of the butterfly effect, it has been something that I think I've begun to see as being my subject. And whether it's 400 years ago, as in this one, or extremely contemporary, as in Shalimar the Clown immediately before it, it seems to me that's I'm trying to wrestle with the problem of how to make a novel work if you do that. You know, and it's surprising how many people there still are who have a strong resistance to books that try and do that. You know, because of this traditional view of the novel as being smaller in scale. You know, but many of the novels I've most admired as a reader over the centuries have been the grand, you know, the everything books. You know, the you know, War and Peace, you know, or Tristram Shandy, or, you know, books that really try and drag in as much of the world rather than, as Jane Austen does, leave out most of it in order to concentrate on one strand of it. I mean, I prefer the everything novel, you know, and I think that's, I guess, what I've been trying to write.
What I want to say is that one of the reasons I love your work so much is that reading it, as someone who grew up in a Pakistani immigrant household, it was the first time I read something for which I felt that I was the intended audience and that it was written for me, for my story, for my experiences, and especially in the way you use language and the way you play with it and make English very much your own. And so I was wondering if that's something intentional on your part, and whether you conceive of a particular audience when you write.
Yes, they've all been written for you. I'm very happy to meet you at last.
Feeling is mutual.
Thanks. There you are. Next. No, let me say one more thing. I mean, I remember reading a wonderful piece by the African American writer Ralph Ellison, you know, famously the author of one novel, Invisible Man, in which he was asked a similar question about who he was writing for. And he said rather beautifully, I think, that he was writing first and foremost for what was then called the Negro community. And he then said, and for anyone else I can get. and that's I think, as good a description as any. I mean, I always felt from Midnight's Children onwards that if the people about whom the books were written did not recognize them as truthful, then it didn't matter how many prizes they won. There would have been something wrong with them, you know. And for me, it's always been a matter of special pride that those books, from the early books onwards, were recognized by Indian readers as having something truthful to say about their lives. So that's true. I mean, it started with that, you know. But then I'm kind of lucky that I have lots of other readers too, and I'm not trying to diss them either. But because I think the thing is, you see, it's the gift that literature, speaking as a reader, that literature could give us as readers, is to give us worlds which are not our own world and make us feel that they are. Long before I came to the United States, I had read a lot of American literature, and I felt I knew something about this country because of that, you know, because of everything from Roth and Bellow to Faulkner and Eudora Welty, you know. So I've never been to Russia, actually, apart from a very brief visit. And what I know about Russia, I know from the writing, for I know from Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Pushkin and Bulgakov and Nabokov and Solzhenitsyn and so on. And Latin America, again, I mean, I had never been to Latin America when I first read Borges and García Márquez and so on. And yet, in reading them, I felt that the world was completely open to me, you know. And then later on, many years later on, I went to South America and discovered that it actually was like that, you know, that they weren't making it up, that it actually was. And this is, I think, the one thing I will say about my writing and the magic realists of South America, which I think people often push together in a way that's not exactly right. But the thing that is true is that we are writing about very weird places, you know, and the weirdness of the writing comes out of the weirdness of the places. And that in many ways, I've always thought about my writing is that it's not magic realism, it's not fantasy, it's understatement. because the real places are so much more bizarre that you couldn't possibly make them convincing if you wrote them down. So, and I remember when Midnight's Children came out, that people in America and Europe tended to respond to the fantasy elements in the book, whereas people in India read it like a history book. You know, I mean, I recall some, being, you know, I was much younger. I went to Bombay just after the book came out, and this young guy about my age came up to me, and he said, "You know, I could have written your book. I know all that stuff." and I mean, I took it as a compliment, you know, because what he was saying was that it, in a way, he's saying what you were saying, which is that the book expressed some kind of shared common knowledge and common experience, you know, and I'm very proud of that. So yes, it's written for you, but maybe one or two other people. Maybe you would lend your copies to one or two other people. Thank you. Yeah, sorry to go up here now. Yes, thanks.
Good evening. A number of months ago, I went to see Isabel Allende. She was in town. She was speaking, and somebody asked her the question, "What motivated you to start writing?" And she answered, "Well, I was very lucky to have a highly dysfunctional family." And it went, it all stemmed from there. And so I want to ask you that question. What motivated you to start writing? How have you developed that ability over time?
Yeah. You don't want to know my family. Well, at least you want to know some of them. But a lot of them. I mean, I had an uncle, to give you an example. I had an uncle who, after the Iranian fatwa was declared against the satanic verses, took out an advertisement in the local newspaper in Rawalpindi in Pakistan to say, essentially, we never liked him anyway. and you know, don't blame us. You So, yeah. I remember when I was at Cambridge, the provost, the president of my college at Cambridge, King's, was a great anthropologist, Edmund Leach, and he gave a famous lecture in England which caused a certain amount of controversy at the time about the family. And its famous opening sentence was, if I remember correctly, what did he say? He said, the family with its narrow privacy and tawdry secrets is the source of all our discontents. And I think that's a wise remark. No, I mean, I didn't really become a writer in order to trash my family. But it was a useful side effect.
You are celebrated as a uniter of East and West, and I'm wondering how storytelling for you relates to your hopes for the world, and if this itself relates to how you choose to begin the writing process with historical fact.
I don't know. You know, I mean, I always hesitate to offer a utilitarian view of literature. You know, because I mean, I think there's something. It's very important to say about books, fiction, that it's useless. or at least those books which set out deliberately to have messages and great social projects are very often tedious books. Every so often there's a book which sets out to do something like that and does it without being tedious. And I mean, I guess an example of that would be Uncle Tom's Cabin, you know. But there are relatively few books which have that kind of direct relationship with a social consequence. You know, and I think literature does change the world, but I think the way in which it does it is much harder to measure because it does it one reader at a time. You know, it's put it like this, that when you fall in love with a book, and it does something to you which is a permanent change. The consciousness of the work of the artist in some way shifts your consciousness, and the way in which you afterwards see the world is to some tiny degree affected by the experience of reading that book. Now, it may be that we don't love that many books in a lifetime. It may be that we love 5, you know, or 50, but it's probably not a very, very large number. But those books that we really take to our hearts are books which change us and shape us. And that's, I think, the power of the form. And the great magic of it is that we don't know when it's going to happen. You know, I don't know whether my book will do that to you or to anyone, and you don't know when you pick up a book if that's what's going to happen to you. It's precisely because it's impossible to predict it that we can have this art form, because it's not essentially didactic. You know, I think a book which sets out to teach you something, I mean, a novel which sets out to teach you something, essentially, I don't want to read. anyway, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this reading of The Enchantress of Florence on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.